Hello and welcome to the EV Cafe Takeaway, that podcast focused on a zero emission future that we all hope for. Every week we've got one of the wonderful members of the team from the EV Cafe to help me along because I need lots of help. JC, welcome.
Hello, I'm really excited about today because this is somebody who's really done stuff.
And we'll find out why.
Really done stuff, like not just talked about it, done stuff.
Indeed, indeed, and it's very exciting. And we have, of course, as always, an innovator, pioneer, collaborator, extraordinaire in the man, the legend, James Rooney from Network Rail, head of fleet there. Tell me, how are you, James?
I'm good, thank you. That's an excellent, excellent introduction. I'd quite like that on my business card, but it would have to be about this long to accommodate it, I think. So, but very good. I like that.
Now then, James, it's 30 degrees out there, and I want to talk to you about rails, and I want to understand why they buckle and why we can't get trains going anywhere. What's going on?
It's a really good question, and sadly, I actually know the answer. Working in the rail industry, I'm born and bred, but I even know the answer with rails. So they paint them white in some cases, and they expand as they get hotter, and we tension them to certain tolerances. And if you go to Spain, they tension them to different tolerances, which is why in the UK, when it gets sort of Spanish hot, our rails aren't necessarily ready for it. So there you go.
See? It's an education.
Oh, my goodness. Absolutely. Well, but, you know, and today is going to be an education, of course. But, James, before we get too much further, it would be probably good for the listeners to understand why you know so much about rail, and perhaps give us an overview of your role within probably the biggest rail sort of company in the country, I would guess.
Indeed, yeah. So I'm James Rooney, head of road fleet in Network Rail. It's quite weird. I'm calling it road fleet. I realise to most people on this podcast, watching this, the internet sphere. And that's because in the rail world, we have two fleets. We have those with steel wheels, boo. We have those with rubber wheels, yay. And I look after, obviously, the latter. Network Rail is an arm's length government body. We're owned, if you like, or managed, overseen by Department for Transport, DfT, and it's our job to look after all of the rail. So we look after the roads for trains, we look after all of that. We don't look after the trains themselves, and we don't look after the freight, although changes are coming. You might have heard about something called GBR, Great British Rail, coming, and that looks to change that. They talk about bringing track and train together, and it's all positive stuff, but that's a little bit future-facing. We're 5 minutes away from that yet. And my job is to look after the road fleet. We have about 9,800 vehicles, and that's comprised of cars, vans, and lovely little HGVs.
Excellent. So prepare yourself to be diplomatically correct, because I'm sure you'll have to be, or politically correct in a second. So the government have a rather large gun at your head to say your fleet must be all electric by the end of 2027. So what is the reality for that? Because that is one massive, tall order. And I'm sure conversation is happening between you and the good people at the DfT and government and so on to say, this might not quite be possible. How is all of that conversation going? And I mean, listen, tell me to shut up and mind my own business if it needs to be all, you know, Secret Squirrel and MI5. But what can you tell us?
I mean, there's, as you would imagine, with anything like this, there's a lot of conversations ongoing at all levels, including right up to our directors. And we know that we won't be able to fulfill absolutely everything by 2027. What we're trying to do is get the vast majority of stuff that we can, where suitable, where applicable, in by that deadline. So cars, for example, done deal. Let's stop talking about it. Anyone that says they can't transition cars in this day and age needs their head looking at. It's a done deal. Problem with vans, as I'm sure we all know, is that it's a bit of an odd sector. So small vans, we've seen very little innovation in, and we're still struggling with small vans that do 120, 130 miles in real life usage. And, you know, something new in the small van sphere comes out and it's still got a 40 or a 50 kilowatt battery. It's still a bit of a laggard. medium vans starting to break away. You know, we've got the custom out now. We've got the Verizon Super Van and things like that. Great to see a bit of innovation there, sort of approaching the 200 real world stuff. And then large vans, remarkably, is actually a bit of a breakaway. But the issue we've got with that is the 4.25 ton derogation on that. And obviously that is precluding us for, at the moment, because of the 60-mile range piece or 62-mile range piece away from base. That's our main issue with it. So we've got that, and we've got 4x4s. 4x4s actually have an official dispensation from the agreement. So can I sit here and say, are we going to absolutely smash 2027? No, I can't. Can I say that, you know, are we going to do absolute best endeavours? Yes, it's a politician's answer, and I apologise for that, but I work in an arm's-length government fleet. You'll find I do it at times. Yes, we are, and we're going for the maximum volume we can. We're working really hard. And ultimately, you know, DFT, they look after us. We want to please them. We want to do as well as we can. Mm. It's a government target. Mm. We are responsible, and we're part of the public image of Network Rail. So we do have a duty to do best that we can, but it's only where there's technology available and viable for it.
Fantastic, James. I mean, that's a very comprehensive answer, and I sort of expected nothing less. You mentioned about the 4.25 ton derogation and this journey, this distance. We've got a number of limitations on 4.25 ton vehicles. That one of them is that if you travel more than 62 miles from base, and then you've got to define base and all of these other things, you end up having a tachograph, and the tachograph comes with a whole bunch of challenges. I mean, not least because you have to do a lot more recording. So fully understand that legislation, which is in consultation as we speak now in June of 2025, hopefully we should get some more information very soon to kind of give us that freedom that we hope for at 4.25 ton. John.
I'm just fascinated to understand, James, you will doubtless have scenario planned this and looked at what is the realistic timescale to meet the government's target. And you'll have doubtless had to feed that back to government. What are you aiming at? What's the realistic approach to get to 100% electric for you?
So there's about four or five scenarios we've modelled to try and knock this, you know, as quickly as we can. The main issue with hitting 2027 head on, and it's the end of 2027, it's closer play 2027 is the target, is more technology than anything else. So it's not the fact that, you know, we've got vehicles on lease precluding it. You know, there are some elements around that where financially we could do some things to move some things around, but it is technology based. So we are absolutely at the mercy almost of the van delivery of new models and things like that. So there's a two or three big ticks which I could have put on my inbox, which would really, really help me motor on. First one's obviously that 4.25 ton piece, and the government are absolutely cracking on with that. The consultation obviously being the first nod to that being done in earnest. And we know, I think we all know that'll probably end up being a positive move, but we just kind of don't know when. But that happening, tick number one. Tick number two is I need a really, really good small van. And that's my main preclusion at the minute. And at the moment, I'm not hearing too much noise from manufacturers. If there are manufacturers watching this call who go, I've got a 200-300 mile small van coming out, my phone number's everywhere. Please find it, call me. And it'll go to voicemail, but leave one. do let me know, because that's one of our big issues. And at the minute, we're looking at, you know, converting cars into vans. Think back to the old Ford Escort van days. It's, you know, we're kind of back there, which is a bit weird. And then medium van, yeah, a little bit more innovation there would be great. So to give you a confirmed date, I can't. It's going to be before 2030, of course it will be, because, you know, by that point we're at 70% of sales with the EV mandate anyway, so we've got to be there. Where it will land between 27, 2030 and volumes and things, we're at the mercy of the markets largely. This is, we will flex and we'll deliver as much as we can, as aggressively as we can. And you know, to of course I'm going to big at Network Rail. That's going to be my job. But, you know, the one thing I can give us credit for is we've got over 440 depots and we've got five regional teams who do an absolutely sterling job of managing their local fleet. But equally, they've also spun up their own little departments, which effectively are delivering all the charging infrastructure, the DNO upgrades and all of that good stuff. Bearing in mind a depot to Network Rail is a porter cabin on a bit of gravel railway siding. Yeah. You know, it was put there in the 60s or 80s and was designed to run a kettle and a bit of fluorescent lighting. It was never designed to run the fleet. So, you know, all of that is spun up and we can sort of turn that dimmer switch up or down a little bit depending on how much influx of vehicles we've got coming in. But yeah, ultimately, you know, we'll deliver as hard and fast as we can, but we're going to be technology led. Mm.
Do you find people are positive about electric vehicles within your teams? Are you having to do a great big behaviour change piece and take people along on a journey? Or is it very much that because you are that at arm's length organisation that your staff understand that they'll just have to do what they have to do?
I'm really glad you asked that question, actually, because we have a thing internally called Viva Engage, Yammer it used to be called. I think most companies have got these days.
Yeah.
And I put something on the other day. So we've just come back as a fleet team from Rail Live. Very exciting event. Think of Fleet News, but, you know, rarely. And or a fleet event, I should say, but rarely. We also have a little fleet section there. Where we talk about what we're doing. We try to show the rail industry. I've been there for 3 years on the trot. The first year I went with three electric vans and I had a grunty Scottish railwayman, and I won't do the Scottish accent because I won't do that any favours and you'll lose viewers. But it came up and went, you know, that won't work. I don't know why you're forcing this onto us. I don't understand the benefit. Diesel's king, you know. Do you like Musk and all of the, you know, the tosh that we've all heard for years and years and years around EV? And it's a bit disheartening, and probably quite a lot of fleet managers feel similar. In every day you go out and get a bit of a kicking from people who don't believe it. And, you know, what I have found this year, we went, it's changed. And I think it's changed for a number of reasons. Some is that, you know, we are doing some really, really positive PR, lots of bums on seats, lots of show and tell, lots of road shows and positive engagement. The first vehicles have gone out. We've made sure that we have, you know, regional ambassadors for them. Think of when you go into the Apple shop to buy a phone or a watch or an iPad or whatever it is, and you have a geek come up to you with an iPad around their neck and they talk really, really, really passionately about why the next iPad is definitely better than the last one. We've kind of got that, but with vehicles in our depots, and they can talk really intelligently about it and go, actually, it's electric. Yeah, okay, fine. It'll do what you need it to do. But did you know it's got cruise control and Apple CarPlay and air conditioning that works? And, you know, and all of these positive bits. And suddenly the fact it's missing a clutch and a gear stick and it makes no noise is kind of not the important bit. Did you know it's got cruise control and lane assist and whatever else? And we're going down the positives. And to go back to this show, which was literally yesterday, the first few people come up to me and go, Yeah, I understand that. In fact, I'm looking at buying this. It was an ID4 we had incidentally at the time. I'm looking at buying one of those myself. And you think, fab, we're starting to get there. We're starting to just crest that hill.
Good man.
It is good, isn't it? Yeah. And it is so exciting to see, you know, this change beginning to happen. And I mean, I had a conversation yesterday with a group of people in the minibus market, and it was great to see them beginning to sort of reflect on where the market was going and the positivity around cars. And I mean, yes, reflecting on some of the challenges, but of course, I think that whole bums on seats bit, when people start realizing the value and the benefits of driving electric and the pleasure that you can get from it, not only from the tech, but actually the drive itself, it's pretty cool. Pretty damn cool. Now, I wanted to introduce a bit of common ground between you and my lovely friend here, JC, James. And that is the city of Southampton, where you got your degree.
Centre of the world.
This is John's hometown.
Absolutely. Good city. Big fan.
Good man. Yeah, it is. And it, you know, Southampton's one of those places you immediately think port. I don't. I think railway. I think Southampton Central Station, which was the centre of my world as a young man. Travelling on the train was the only option that I had. And it was brilliant, takes you from the centre of my little town right into the centre of the city where you could just enjoy the best of any city. It was just brilliant. Love it. And, you know, Network Rail, keep that system running despite huge challenges. And don't think you get thanked enough for the job you do. You know, there's a lot of moaning and mumping about, mumping as we call it in Scotland, you know, misery around rail travel. But actually, it's fantastic. And I would use rail above everything else as my first choice. So bless you.
Thank you very much. And going into Network Rail, I knew as much about it as probably most other people know about Network Rail, which is delays, trains, you know, whatever else. And actually, you look at this system and it's fabulous. It's absolutely fabulous. We're the biggest landowner in the UK. We use the majority, we're the largest electricity user in the UK as a single, you know, origin type thing. It's mind-boggling how much we have to look after, and Southampton actually is a really, really key town for us. We've got Eastleigh Works there, which is a massive depot just next to the airport, funny enough, where I'm based, and that's one of our pivotal sites for us. And all around the country you've got these key sites where the railway made that city, you know, and it's got such historical precedence around it, and you meet people who are incredibly passionate about what it brought to the town or what it means. And yeah, it's fun. And I mean that sincerely.
No, and Southampton with the worst football team in the world. In the world.
No comment.
Yes, well, nobody's going to disagree with you, John, sadly. But what I noticed is that you, James, you took on a couple of things, geography with a focus on marine, and you've ended up somewhere different. What was it that you were aspiring to as you sort of walked through the door at Southampton University and sort of mapped out your future? What was going through your mind as you took the degree?
It wasn't looking after Network Rail's fleet, actually. That was at least second on the list for that day. So a bit of potted history behind me. Wanted to be a pilot. Desperately just wanted to be a pilot, a military pilot at that. Sadly, I'm too blind and I have to wear specs for a living, despite the fact the contacts are in today, but I had to wear specs for a living. And at the time, might still be the case, you couldn't apply. Had to look at something else. Still wanted to join the Navy. Although I went to uni in Southampton, I'm actually a Portsmouth boy by roots. So in Portsmouth, you generally do one of two things. You mm-hmm. leave or you join the Navy. Ended up going to try and join the Navy. And had a chat with them and they said, actually, you know, what are the roles you're looking at? And I've always been interested in geography. I've always been interested in travel and things like that, and took particular interest in doing something like the British Antarctic Survey and things like that, to which the Navy said, well, go and do a oceanography degree and we'll, you know, talk to you when you come back in 3 years. Trotted off to university, went and did that, came back and said, right, I'm ready to look at penguins now. And they went, yeah, unfortunately, we just had this thing called the credit crunch, circa 2009-ish. And they went, we were the only employer, because everyone else was obviously making layoffs at that time. And they had no capacity. So go away, do something for a year or two, come back, we'll have you in. And I thought, yeah, lovely. So I thought, well, bugger, what am I do? And I've always wanted to be a mechanic deep down. Always wanted to be a mechanic. I love spanning on things. At home, I've got a couple of NAF cars. You know, I've got three cars and all of them are worth about £8. But it's fun. You know, they're things I look after. They're kind of my happy place to look after. And wanted to be a mechanic and decided to go into that realm. And I ended up joining British Gas on their graduate program into fleet. And here I am. So yeah, I ended up going a slightly different direction, but in an area I'm incredibly passionate about, which is I am a petrol head. Always have been, I think always will be. And EV doesn't scare me because it means we get to keep cars on the road. I think if we didn't have EV saving cars, then someone would say, get rid of cars.
It's a funny thing, indeed, isn't it? I share that passion. I was a motoring journalist and loved cars, all cars, have done since I was a little boy. But it's a consistent theme that we come across is that those who are championing the cleaner, better, more efficient vehicles are the ones who really have a foot in both camps. And what is not understood by pure petrol heads is that you can actually like both. That's okay. It actually works. It balances itself out.
100%. I completely agree. I mean, don't get me wrong. There's nothing I enjoy more than the sound of a great big V8, you know, or something like that. And it will be a sad day when that's banished. But I think, you know, it's, I'm hoping what happens to petrol and diesel cars, or maybe petrol cars with big engines, is what happens to horses, in that horses used to be absolutely everywhere and used to do everything. And now they're a fun thing, you know, done for sport or leisure. And I'm hoping that'll be the way of the big V8, and electric will come along and take over all the stuff that it doesn't need that element to it. I mean, when was the last time you jumped in a commercial vehicle and thought, oh, that diesel engine sounds a bit leery? No, never. It sounds horrible. Go away. So, you know, it's absolutely the right thing to do. And, you know, you jump into a Polestar, a BMW, a Tesla, anything like that, and you think, this drives superbly. Yeah. It drives absolutely superbly. Mm. So, yeah, don't be afraid of it and embrace it, because it might well be the saviour of driving. You know, yeah. I think otherwise they'd have to find something to get rid of it completely, wouldn't they?
Can I just interject on your horse comment? Horses are not, I mean, they can be fun, but boy, they're expensive, they're painful, they break down a lot, they cause all kinds of stress. I suppose it's like tinkering with a V8. But James, do tell us, what is your favourite car?
Oh, so
I've still
have my favourite car. So my first car and my favourite car was a Ford Capri. So I am still the proud owner of a 1986 Ford Capri Laser 1.6 diamond white, same colour as the Transit van. And that happily sits at home. It's in the garage under a cloth for 98% Brilliant. Of the year and probably does 1,000 miles. But it's my absolute baby.
I know. So I have seen James turn. You've turned up to one event we were at. I think it was at Company Car in Action, maybe a year ago, or it was one of them. So I didn't see you turn up. But the Ford Capri of yesteryear and now the Ford Capri today. What are your thoughts on that? Oh. I'll just give you my opinion, just for the record. I think it's it looks nothing like it. It's like, what have you done to the Ford Capri? But anyway.
Ford, if you're listening, please take a page out of Renault's book. The Explorer, which I know the Ford Capri is basically the same platform, is phenomenal. Very good car, very competent, sensible, good car, like it. Thumbs up. The Capri, you're just cashing in a name. I would have personally probably called it. Call it something new. Everyone likes a new car name.
Right. Okay. So we talked about commercial vehicles a little while ago, and you said there's nothing much out there which is floating your boats right now. If you were to spec to a manufacturer what your needs are, what would they be?
So thank you. Like that a lot. Small van. So I'm talking combo size, you know, Courier, Connect, that caddy, that type of van. What we realistically need is an 90, if you can squeeze it in, 80 kilowatt battery in a van of that size with about 700, 800 kilograms of payload. And what I find interesting is a small van, you can have up to, well, in theory, you can have it to 3.5 tons, but, you know, you can have up to sort of about 2.83 tons if you look at a combo, for example. So there does seem to be enough payload, floating around to get that size of battery in plus the payload required. And I can only presume, and I am making a big presumption, and I'm sorry, Mr. and Mrs. Manufacturer, if you've gone to all these efforts and I'm completely wrong. Again, phone number will be somewhere, shout at me, but... I think we're dealing with legacy architecture still. It's still very much a diesel or a petrol product that effectively was kind of squished a few AAs in underneath and put a motor in the bonnet and gone on down the road. We've not really seen the first ever electric proper chassis for a small van. And we're starting to see that on large. That's really refreshing to see. Medium, you've just got more room to play with, I suppose. But, the, you know, you've got the super van coming and things like that. Small van, yet to see it. And nearly 3,000 of my vehicles are small vans. And, you know, you look at the post office or Royal Mail, pardon me, you know, people like that. It's this big, big sector.
Mm. Why is that? Paul, you got any sense of that? Have you got any sense of why the market hasn't captured this?
So I think James's point is absolutely right. I think there is a limitation in the physical architecture, because when you consider a wheelchair accessible vehicle, and they're built typically or historically have been built on things like the Kangoo, the Combo, the Doblo, all of the small version. What happens when you try and do that today on a wheelchair accessible vehicle is you go to cut the floor out and the battery's there. So I think they haven't got enough space for a bigger battery. And if you make it deeper, then you push the floor up. And that seems to be an issue with the size of battery. I think the Kia PV5 is a really nice looking van. I think the price point is excellent. I think everything is really positive about that. What I am disappointed at is that they have not taken the option to do a ground up electric vehicle that has no diesel architecture and really go for it, both in charging speed and also battery size. And so I was a little bit confused. So I'm hopeful that somebody, you know, is going to come along and solve that problem. But in the meantime, we might end up with the what is it, the Volvo EX30 and the Skoda Enyaq, the cars that are actually now being converted into sort of panel vans and car derived vans, but they'll never make it under 2 tons, I don't think, so it won't be true car derived vans, but they'll do the job of a car derived van. Would that be something that's an option? Oh, John, go on.
Yeah, well, I just wonder, James, you talked about innovation and you've both set out very cogently precisely what it is that you need. What bothers me is that ordinarily you'd have an innovator step in and say, do you know what? We can do that. That's not difficult, what you're asking us to do. What is difficult is survival in automotive, and that you have innovation coming in. We've seen it time after time. Volta's the latest to struggle. And it's really sad because we're now leaving it to the legacy OEMs to say, oh, OK, well, we'll use our 5, 6, 7 year lead times to design something that you need right now, whereas innovation can deliver that probably in 2, 3 years. But the risks are massive. It just frustrates me that we can't seem to pull together as commercial entities that you have and the post office have and other businesses have to collectively almost guarantee innovation. You make the thing, we'll buy it from you.
Yeah, I wasn't going to speak about Canoe on this call. And obviously, they're probably one of the most recent to fall victim in the small van sector. Yeah. I was absolutely bummed out when that happened. Really, really gutted. Because for once, there was a product which actually looked, you know, 95, 98% spot on, 80 kilowatt battery, you know, correct payload. Okay, it had some Americanisms about it, which we maybe have to Europeanize a little bit. But other than that, you know, it was there or thereabouts. You definitely win it round. And we've had some trials going, things like that. But it went bump. And it's, you know, the automotive world is incredibly difficult. And in the design and initial phases, you've got factories set up, you've got stakeholders to manage, you've got design, you've got all of the safety kit, and you've got to then manage that and all of the homologation stuff. So you're burning through cash like billio. And realistically, you know, you're not going to be making any of that back for 5 or 6 years. And you go and talk to any major OEM and they'll say, well, most brand new ground up vehicles are sometimes 15 years apart. I mean, I'm not picking on VW because they've got the ID Buzz, actually, which is filling quite a good example for a small van. But if you look at the last generation Transporter, the T6, from the T5 to the T6, they sweated that through about 3 different iterations. Okay, yeah, they kept upping the engines into Euro 6, Euro 5 to Euro 6, etc. But the chassis of that vehicle was sweated for nearly 15 years. And you think, yeah, it was just all designed around diesel. It was no wonder that ABT, when they put a couple of batteries in, it couldn't quite make the thing work. And actually, it's only now really that they're doing a joint venture with Ford, have they got a vehicle which does a bit of both. And it's all of those development phases to go through. You're just burning through capital. And if your shareholders, you know, typical venture capitalists, things like that, they give you a bit of cash and they want that times two next year. And in the automotive world, you're not going to get it.
James, what's clear is that you've got a really good vision of what you would like from the industry. Does it frustrate you that you're not getting the opportunity to sort of help manufacturers get the right vehicles? And what do you think are the barriers to getting the right vehicles for you guys right now?
A brilliant question, actually. So we're on a global stage with vehicles, and us as Blighty represent a dot. You know, Europe realistically is relatively small. You know, you compare that to Americas and Asia. Europe's a relatively small demand of vehicles, relatively high-end vehicles, but small demand. So the ones we've got here are usually models where the recuperation period by the manufacturer is made up through a smaller amount of models. It tends to be luxury, definitely tends to be car. And van is almost a compliance piece. You know, they have to do it, so they're almost doing it out of that rather than a wish or a desire to do so. I think we realistically won't see any major change to that until other countries start to come on board. And you're starting to hear more and more noise from America, despite some of the other noise happening over there. You know, more noise happening from there. Australia, massive coal reserves, but they're starting to come onto it because of the wildfires. They're getting more and more. They didn't really believe in climate change for 10 minutes, but now they're much more on board. And actually, Japan was a little bit of a laggard, despite the fact that they were huge on hybrid and hydrogen, things like that. That if you go to Japan, most things are petrol. But even they're starting to clock in. So I think we're going to start seeing it. I'm very fortunate. I've had some very, very good and retained very good manufacturer relationships at a UK and European level. And we're able to have those open conversations, say what's coming, what's next, and lots of, you know, non-disclosure acts and things like that signed so we can see behind the curtain. And there is some exciting stuff coming. But again, you got to remember, it takes 5 or 6 years to develop a vehicle. Chances are they only really woke up to it in 2020, 2021. So, you know, what we've got right now is a little bit of a halfway house.
Yeah. I mean, you got into British Gas like nine years and 11 months you were there. Why didn't you stay for the 10 to get your 10-year watch? Anyway, that's a separate question. But you were involved in some real pioneering stuff, weren't you? What did you learn in that time, and how's that helped you now in Network Rail? Because there was some incredible stuff that you and under your mentor and the leader at the time, Steve Winter, really went to town on getting this electric thing going, didn't you?
Yeah, I mean, it was absolutely and remains absolutely the right thing to do. I mean, there's a number of reasons to move to an EV. And obviously, you know, the main reason people are doing it right now is because we've got no other option. You know, if we don't go EV now, then 2030, 2035 in commercials looming, you know, if you don't get your house in order, then it's going to be quite a surprise. But actually, there's a number of other reasons. As a fleet operator, other than transition to EV, my biggest day-to-day pain and project is vehicle and road time, VOR time. EVs are so much more reliable. No clutch, no DPF, no flywheel, no turbo, no injectors. No, list is endless. You've got one rather large moving part, and you know the rest is electrics. And you know what we're finding is, okay, there's a couple of teething troubles with one or two products. We'll slightly brush that to the side. But generally speaking, EVs do, on the whole, tend to be quite a bit more reliable. I was running Nissan ENV200s back in 2013 at Gas. And we had some of those on fleet for 7 years, over 100,000 miles, and not one breakdown. We'd brakes rust on because the regeneration was using most of it, and but you know, tires and things, but not one breakdown. They were phenomenally reliable, actually, and kudos to Nissan on that product. So you know, long may that go. So there's reliability side. But then there's equally, you know, a number of other elements which are correct for each company. In British Gas, there's a bit of image. You know, I can't speak for them from them at the moment and wouldn't want to, but there's definitely a good image of someone coming around your house to install a smart meter or a solar panel or whatever it be, and you arrive in an electric van. It's good for brand and things like that. And with British Gas as well, of course, they're an energy company. You know, it makes complete sense if you're able to provide electricity to your own fleet. Why wouldn't you? So that was some of the reasoning back in the day to do it. And the order for 2,000 was put in with Vauxhall, and they're still in the fleet now. And I'm glad to see it. And I believe they're in the process of ordering more. And long may that continue. I'm really glad to see that they're doing well. I thoroughly enjoyed working at British Gas. And I'm glad to see they're going from success to success with their EV project.
James, one of the things that we all have to do in our day-to-day work is kind of challenge the perception of EVs. And this morning on the news, I read an article out that said that EVs break down more than petrol and diesel vehicles, according to What Car magazine, 30,000 interviews undertaken. And they said you're more likely to break down, you're less likely to have roadside assistance, be able to fix your vehicle at the roadside. And this really surprised me because I'm surrounded by people like you who say, oh, no, I've been running electric vehicles for donkey's years and they are reliable. They work. Where's the mismatch happening? What's going on? Because they can't both be right.
I think it's a lens. So What Car will be looking at company cars, typically anything between 0 to 3, maybe 4 years old. Fleet managers are looking at a holistic approach of car, van and truck, typically maybe even 6, sometimes even 8 years. And we're looking at a different category of vehicles. We're definitely looking at a different age and usage cycle. So in the company car world, you know, petrol diesel vehicles, you don't get to the point where clutches and flywheels and DPFs and everything, all the other rubbish starts to go wrong because you got shot of it by that point. And actually the EV coming along, which is a bit heavier, might go through some more tires on a car. I'll come back to that in a second because there's a bit of a myth around that. But and all of that good stuff. And there have been some 12 volt battery issues on certain models and things like that. So, you know, all of that is known. But by and large, actually, when you start to especially sweat those vehicles into an older life, the fault mix definitely favors an EV over a traditional diesel. I just want to come back to tires. I did linger on that on purpose. One of the biggest things I hear, and I've heard it from my own company, I've heard it from externals, is that EVs go through tires quicker. It's because of their weight. It's not correct. It's because of how they're driven. You know, some of it's to do with the fact that actually some EV tires come with a couple of millimeters less on the tread in the first place, and that's because they've got lower rolling resistances and things like that. So there's probably some economics within that as well. But with tyres, what we've noticed is actually with an EV, you're giving it M3 power. If all company cars 10 years ago had M3 power, we'd be going through tyres as quickly as we do with EVs. It's because they've got that absolutely enormous power, which makes them quite attractive to certain drivers, but it equally means we go through the tyres quite quickly. What we don't see on commercial vehicles is increased tyre wear. In fact, I'm seeing quite the opposite. On our vans, we're seeing slower tyre wear than we do on the diesel versions.
Well, and it brings me quite nicely to a little side question, because I know you have a particular passion for a certain part of France, and by that I mean Le Mans, and I know that you head over every year. Is there do you see a place for electric in the world of motor racing? I mean, outside of Formula E, of course, but could you imagine Le Mans becoming electric?
There's a cracker. So, I mean, there is an element of that. I think motorsport, part of it, it's theatre, isn't it? Let's be honest. It's the snap, crackle and bang as some ridiculous hypercar flies past you at a billion miles an hour. So that they're already trying to lean into that. So all of the fuel provided by Total is zero carbon fuel. Apparently it comes from
sustainable
fuel. So it comes from vineyards, I believe. It's almost like wine waste. So I don't know if they're running on a bit of Merlot or something, but whatever it is they're running on. So in theory it's decarbonized already. Electric sports cars do exist. There was the VW ID, whatever it is, that ballistic thing that did Pikes Peak as quick as anything's ever been done ever. I think some of it is there's how quick can a car go, and almost we've got to the point where everyone goes, yeah, I know electric's quicker, but petrol sounds a bit better. And I think that theatre will have to remain. So what I suspect motor racing will do, it kind of comes back to my horse analogy, I think that will always stay a little bit retrograde. I think it will always be a little bit, all right, it's old school technology, but you know, nothing makes people go, woo, as something goes past them and a flash of flame comes out of the exhaust as it corners and goes away. But it might be that we run it on, yeah, old plonk or hydrogen or something else. I don't know. But there's a place for EV racing, but I think the crowd will ask for noise.
It sounds like me at the weekend running on Merlot. Anyway.
Sorry, I thought you meant old plonk.
Same sort of thing. But no, I'm very with you. But I will say there's plenty of theatre in the fastest vehicle going up Goodwood. Was it last year? Which was, of course, the Ford Transit van. Mm. And it was noisy. I mean, it sounded like a spaceship. And it was a van. Anyway, now we have a closing tradition on the podcast. And that closing tradition, James, do you know what the closing tradition is?
I'm ashamed to say
He's
I don't.
He's never listened to us.
Anyway,
that's now. Fine. So, yes, indeed. So the closing tradition is we present you with a magic wand with its own little lightning bolt and straight out of Harry Potter. Here it comes. And because you are about to get one wish, sir. Come on, there you go. Could he be the first person that's never grabbed it? Oh, no, there it is.
It amazes me how highly intelligent people grab the wand.
The fake wand.
That's the whole... Yes, the fake wand. Hey, it's not fake. It's real. Stuff happens as a result of people's wishes, let me tell you. So, James, you have one wish. You can use it any which way you like. We've had somebody wish for a Michelin star chef to follow them around. We've had the wish that, you know, the press would not be allowed to print false stories. We've had all kinds of wishes. Some brilliant ones. And we should do a little series of wishes.
Maybe anyway. A book.
But yes, a book. Yes, Stephen Bartlett seems to have done all right out of that sort of thing. But James, what is your wish?
Oh, cracky me. Flying cars. I mean that sincerely. Absolutely flying cars. Or always, always has been. Whether it be like a drone thing or something else. You've got to remember my childhood dream was to be a pilot and I work in the car industry. I want to blend both those together. Flying cars every day of the week.
Fantastic. I love the definiteness about it. There's something close already in the drone world, I think. And it's the landing pad is one of the landing pads is in Bicester
Heritage.
What do they call it? Heritage. Bicester Heritage. Yeah, where just by where the fire was, unfortunately, but there is a landing pad there for an air taxi that can kind of come in and go out. But I imagine you're sort of thinking the wheels become propellers and just kind of up you go. And do you want it to do both, or does it always have to fly?
Whatever the third Back to the Future car was, that one, the one that just sort of like, yeah, that's what I'm after. The DeLorean that has the food processor on the back and can fly. That's the idea.
Let's see what we can do.
This has been a real pleasure to chat with you today. And I knew it would be, and I knew that it would be so much fun. John, what are your final thoughts of our lovely friend James?
Do you know what? It's lovely to talk to somebody who allows the substance of what he says to outshine the flamboyance of some people that are in the world who talk a lot but don't actually deliver much. You are based in fact in everything you do. Your experience shines through. I've learned a lot, actually, today. I think the question I asked around, you know, the report from What Car, you calmly just dissected it, gave facts. It's just not the case. And you don't get overexcited about it. It's just a matter of fact. And I like James Rooney's facts.
Thank you. I like you.
There you go. Despite all your flamboyance and noise and big...
Presenter I'll never be.
But magnificent guest, but you most certainly are.
Brilliant guest. Yes. There we go. Absolutely. We are all agreed. James Rooney deserves an OBE and all of those good things. But James, listen, we do wish you all the very, very best with what is a huge task and challenge at Network Rail. One that you and I know a couple of other members of your team are working really hard to deliver. And I hope that you get the support that you need from the government, you know, because they have a very big vested interest in all of this. And that we see this transform before our very eyes and that your solutions and your problems get solved. And above all, we want to see your wish come true.
Thank you very much,
James. Thank you so much. And everybody, as James has alluded to already today, his number is everywhere. You can connect with him on LinkedIn. James, are you on Instagram? Do you do all of that nonsense?
Or I am on my car. You, has an Instagram.
Steer clear. Oh, well, that we must follow. So what is so well, that will be in the link. You'll need to give us the link for. So tell us what it is, James.
It's Clapped Out to Classic. It's about the Capri. Of course it is. Most things in my life are all linked to Fleet. My wife wonders what's wrong with me.
It sums Paul and I up beautifully. Clapped Out and Classic. You can decide which one.
Brilliant. So connect with James. And obviously, if you've liked this podcast, then there is many others, as John alluded to earlier, 120 or something. Go check it out. We've got some great people from Fleet. We've got some great people from Automotive. All across, we've got a wonderful selection of people that you can listen to and learn from, just like we have today. James, another very big thank you very much. And same to you, John, for joining me and helping me, because I need help. Have a great day, everybody, and we look forward to seeing you again soon.
Take care.
Thanks a lot.